Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jacqueline Meredith. This episode features content from an educational virtual symposium titled Anticipating Resistance in HAPVAP, Strategies to Improve Empiric Regimens in the ICU, featuring pharmacists Marian Ellickson, Dr. Keith Kay, and Dr. Andrew Shore. In this episode, they discuss ways to improve empiric treatment of HAPVAP in the intensive care unit. For more information about our expert faculty and for a link to the full online educational program, including downloadable slides, please visit the link in the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what they have to say about this topic.
I am Keith Kay. I'm the Chief of Division of Allergy, Immunology, and Infectious Diseases at Rogers Robb Ward Johnson Medical School in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I'm joined by Marian Ellickson, who is a BSc, PhM, and many other titles there I'm not going to say. She's a practice-based researcher. She's at Sunnybrook Research Institute and also is the Antimicrobial Stewardship Pharmacy Lead. She's at the Department of Pharmacy and Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center. And Dr. Andrew Shore. Andrew has an MD, MPH, and of course, an MBA. He's the Director of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at MedStar Washington Hospital Center, Washington, D.C., and really is quite a thought leader in critical care medicine, pneumonia, and in sepsis. I'll kick my first answer off to Andy. In what, if any, patients would you consider empirically starting a novel BLI antibiotic?
We would start a novel agent based on exactly the kind of analytical approach that was described by Marian, although not as quantitative. Right? If we know you're colonized with CRE, if we know you've had an MDR pseudomonas before that's only susceptible to certain things, that's where we would try to start it. Other than that, we pretty much reserve them as destination therapy. But we try to get that destination therapy on board as soon as possible.
I'm going to ask Marian this question. For places that do not have ICU antibiograms, how would you suggest that they select empiric antipsychotic coverage?
Yeah, I guess that's challenging. I think you really need to think about your local antibiogram. But in absence of that, there are, at least in where I'm from in Canada, a lot of regional antibiograms that you can refer to. And we have our Public Health Agency of Ontario that puts out antibiograms. So looking for your next best thing, I think that's what you really where you have to go. It might not be specific to your institution, but usually these things are regional patterns, not just hospital specific. So going to your next best resource.
Thank you. We have a question from George. Any comment on the clinical prediction score DRIP, D-R-I-P, for empiric nosocomial coverage?
Yeah, so DRIP was developed to address the healthcare-associated pneumonia kind of patient, not the nosocomial pneumonia patient. So the DRIP score has 4 points, deals with certain things. There have been a number of these scores that have been developed to help, again, get away from the healthcare-associated pneumonia concept, but maintain focus on the fact that resistance still shows up to the ER. So you don't give PIP-TAS vanco to everybody, but there are still patients who may be coming from an LTAC or recently hospitalized. DRIP is one of those scores. It has an AUC of about 0.85, so it's not perfect. We developed a score that's a little bit different, looking more at severity of illness and taking that into account. There's a Japanese score. All of these scores really lack substantial external prospective validation. They all may have some form of internal validation, but not external validation. And they're all based, and what's interesting is they all come to somewhat similar conclusions about certain variables, like prior antibiotic exposure or being super sick. But then they vary a lot. Like, for example, in the Japanese one, you know, known aspiration is a big deal, which isn't in the others. And so it gets a point back to the point that it's not clear how well these tools cross institutional or regional boundaries. Because again, the risk factors in Washington, D.C. for resistance, because of how we use antibiotics, because of social determinants of health, because of who knows what factors, is different from what you may see in Central Jersey, different from what you may see in Toronto. So it's not clear if these scores work well. And the scores are all limited because there's kind of a hidden assumption about pretest probability, right? And if you come from a region where none of these patients ever show up to your ER, these scores are never going to, all the scores that give you a result are going to be false positive, right? Because you don't have it. If you're in an area where the prevalence is very high, these scores aren't going to be helpful. because they're going to falsely reassure you something's absent when it's totally prone. So that's what those risk scores are for and their limitations.
Thanks.
I'm going to take the next question. We had a couple questions about why aren't more ICUs using rapid diagnostics for respiratory, lower respiratory tract infection and pneumonia? And also, what do you need to do to make the business case to bring in rapid diagnostics? Well, you know, first of all, I'd say, you know, rapid diagnostics, implementing them without an infrastructure or thought about what to do with the results and without having buy-in. As Andy was saying, it's a, you know, this is very much a team sport, this type of management of these sort of sick patients with pneumonia. Obviously, you need buy-in from your ICU. And a lot of times the BALs that are used are mini BALs or blind. So in our case at Michigan, when I was there, and I know at Northwestern, when the respiratory therapy does them, it's often mini BAL. So you need buy-in and from definitely critical care, obviously. And also, you know, respiratory therapy, if they're going to be doing any of these testing, your micro lab or whoever's going to be processing these. And, you know, you need, and obviously, I think often stewardship, if they're going to be helping to make sure that the results are getting back, your EMR folks as well. So you need to have a plan in place. And, you know, you're going to have to make sure that all the players involved want to do it. And then you're going to have to, you know, talk about time to effective therapy, trialing that, how, while we might not have evidence for improved outcomes, that I think time to effective therapy, Andy has shown data, Marion has referenced the data. Obviously, in sick patients, if you get effective antibiotics on board, it's going to improve outcomes. Just, it seems very sort of logical to me. But some cases, microlab doesn't want to deal with it. I've had, in some cases, the intensivists aren't interested in using this. They're interested in other clinical scores. In other cases, there's just no one's going to suck up the cost and willing to go to bat for it. But Andy, have you had any experience with implementation or trying to implement this stuff?
Some of the problems with the current rapid diagnostics in the respiratory tract is that, unlike the blood, where a lot of rapid diagnostics have been validated, the lungs are not a sterile site. And so if I recover something, how do I differentiate pathogen from colonizer? And if I just get something, you know, if you've had Acinetobacter in your airway, you're going to have Acinetobacter in your airway forever. And so when I grow Acinetobacter, or I find an Acinetobacter by a rapid diagnostic in someone who I think may have pneumonia, it's not helpful to me because I'm not surprised. I think the current generations of rapid diagnostics for the respiratory tract, which are very genetically focused and not giving us quantitative information about the burden of culture or the density of genome in the front versus the background of other pathogens, has really hampered their adoption in respiratory infection. The next generation is addressing, right, where you're going to be able to differentiate colonizer from true pathogen. And when we get there, I think there'll be rapid adoption. And
is that through quantification, or how are they, you know, the technology?
Through, some of it's through quantification. Some of it, you know, just setting the threshold for resolution and picking something up and saying, hey, this is the equivalent of 10 to the third organism. This is the equivalent of 10 to the first organism. We're not going to hit positive until it reaches this threshold.
Marion, if considering, if my site wants to consider implementing advanced antibiograms, what are the initial steps? Who are the key players you want to get at the table? And also, you know, around prediction scores. I mean, are any tips for getting started or key thought leaders that from different departments or?
Yeah, for sure. So we're very lucky to have access to a lot of our microbiology data, but getting your microbiology lab on board to give you full susceptibility panels to the organisms isolated at your site is what's key. We just get them dumped into an Excel spreadsheet and manipulate them to make these advanced antibiograms. So once you have the data, you don't need a fancy software or statistician to manipulate them. For the escalation antibiograms, it was a little bit more of a challenging process because we had to impute some of the gram-negative resistances that weren't tested by our microbiology lab. The clinical prediction scores is the next level. I think you really need you need a lot of patient-level data, so not only your microbiology lab. Our stewardship database takes data from all over the hospital, so we can get patient-specific factors that we can pair with the microbiology results in order to derive these clinical prediction scores. We had a statistician help us with that to derive them. and then to validate them on a second set of data that we pulled from our stewardship system. So that requires more data, but the antibiograms itself, if you can get the data from your microbiology lab, they're really quite easy to manipulate and can be quite useful.
Thanks, Baron. Andy, I'm going to let you read this. I don't know all of my brand names. I know all the generics. I don't want to say the brand names, but I'm going to let you know. It says for refractory HAP after giving, I know ceftazidime-avibactam or ceftolozane-tazobactam, what would be your next choice between these two agents? And I'll let you read them as I don't, it's at the bottom question. I don't know the generics.
Cefiderocol and imipenem-rilabactam.
Thank you.
Cilastatin. You know, I think the other point to remember is when you talk about refractory HAP or patients failing therapy,
right.
I think the better point to realize is sometimes there's drug failure. Sometimes there's dosing failure, but if you've got a patient with augmented renal clearance who's actually probably got a GFR of 150 or 200, and you're not thinking about that, you're underdosing a lot of drugs, and you need to think about those things. But a lot of times there's host failure, and you know no drug's going to rescue a host who's going to fail no matter what. And so when I look at refractory HAP and someone in shock who's dying, it's not always the bug or the drug. It's sometimes it's the host. And we're not going to win all of these battles.
Susceptibility testing would be important at this point when you're having failures. And I'd say if you're at a point where you're using one of your new BLI combinations, I would tee up the other options for testing. Because if you want to switch after thinking about, you know, other reasons why you might be failing other than resistance or, you know, true drug failure that despite appropriate dosing, you want to have in your back pocket susceptibility results. So I don't know that there's a great, I'd probably pick the ones more likely to be susceptible. You know, cefiderocol looks very good in vitro. I think Imirel, well, we have a little bit more experience using, and there is some randomized controlled data using it in resistant Pseudomonas, but I think susceptibilities are going to be really important there. I will ask, Ashfaq, thank you very much for this question. I'll give it to both. But Miriam, why don't you start? Do you see a role for the combination antibiogram in the era of new and better tolerated novel beta-lactam inhibitor combinations that we've talked about? Do you still like the combination antibiogram, or do you think some of these broader spectrum agents that have very good susceptibility against things like Pseudomonas are enough alone?
Yeah, so I mean, I probably have a different view of this being Canadian. So we don't really have access to all of these agents. So we have ceftolozane-tazobactam, but the other agents we have to obtain through special access program, which are really challenging to do. So for us, most definitely, these newer agents aren't really in our back pocket. So we often have to do the combinations in order to deal with these multi-drug resistant organisms.
And I'll be just as a follow-up, you were showing data for your algorithm as, you know, the best likely choice that you would use. Do you have data using combinations as well for that?
No,
I didn't know if you went to the next slide. If you
yeah,
had slide
so yeah, we would like to moving
I think
forward.
That would be really
yeah,
cool.
Definitely. There's a need for that for sure.
Andy, you want to address that? I mean, you do have the new combination. You do have the new agents available. How do you feel about combination?
I think combination is important, and looking at what combinations get you, because it lets you identify when the combination is not likely to be active. Right? There are pathogens out there where, given your best backbone agent traditionally with an aminoglycoside, still isn't going to get you to your 80 or 90%, and you need to know when you're rolling the dice and you're likely. You know, if you're exposing 1 in 5 people. Inappropriate therapy, someone's going to die.
This is a question that was asked about biomarkers that that you rely on to efficiently suggest inadequate empiric antibiotics. We, at some of my institutions I've been at, procalcitonin has been, you know, it's like water. They check it constantly on various individuals. I personally, particularly in the ICU, I haven't found in these types of HAP-VAP patients, I haven't found a good biomarker that adds much to good clinical acumen and good history and good, you know, chart review and good physical exam, good radiographic studies. Are there biomarkers that you lean on that you think are very helpful?
I think the serial biomarkers, clearly the procalcitonin literature shows people who are an antibiotic that you think are effective, and this comes from French and other European studies, and the procalcitonin's going up. That's bad. That's bad juju. But it's no better than, you know, relying on what's called the clinical pulmonary infection score and looking at that over time. And that's got various components. But the biggest component is, in an effort not to wait till the patient's dead to declare them a clinical failure, if someone's got pneumonia and their PaO2 to FiO2 ratio is not getting better by day 1.5, odds are you're exposing the patient to inappropriate therapy. And this comes from some great work that John Muscadier and other colleagues did in Canada from some randomized controlled trials that we were part of. And it shows that if they're, you know, if you're treating pus in the lung, the oxygenation should be improving. Sounds remarkably easy, and it is, but you have to pay attention to it. And you have to say, well, look, they're still on 80% and 10 a peep, and they've been on an antibiotic for 48 hours and they're not getting better. There's a problem. Their oxygenation should be improving.
And another question, how should clinicians use the updated nosocomial pneumonia classifications in clinical practice?
Well, again, I think the way you use them is you learn that some of these diseases that we used to blow off as not being particularly consequential, such as hospital-acquired pneumonia, actually turn out to be substantially consequential. Again, no one's saying the pathogens are different. No one's saying that necessarily your therapeutic approaches need to be different. But I think what they're saying is a lot of things that we used to not take seriously, the burden of nosocomial pneumonia and the more preventable mortality opportunity we have is not for my patients with VAP in the ICU. It's for the patients on the floor who get hospital-acquired pneumonia and then start deteriorating when ID is getting called and other people are getting called. And we need to take those patients seriously and realize that really is a medical emergency.
Yeah, I think that's been the biggest change. And it's been a real, a real change in thought process. That ventilated HAP group, acutely ventilated decompensated HAP patient are the sickest. And those are the ones that, time to effective therapy is always important, but it is super, super duper important in those individuals. And I really like that about the new guidelines. One of the things that, I heard, the new HAP-VAP guidelines are coming out and everyone's like, and there's no more HCAP, blah, blah, blah. And there is no more HCAP, but they don't really address the HCAP patients. So I think they're kind of punting that to the CAP people. So, I mean, what should we think about with it? Individuals who are coming from a nursing home and have a new oxygen requirement and have an infiltrate, or who have been in the hospital 30 days ago and now are coming back on 4 liters and have a schmutzy infiltrate. I mean, what do you do?
So we do what my colleague here to my left does, which is we look at our local data. So we just presented at CHEST this week an analysis of all these patients who came in through the ER with pneumonia. We didn't segregate CAP from HCAP. We just said pneumonia presenting to the ER, ended up on a ventilator. Everybody got a lower airway culture. And we said, look, the question we care about as clinicians is ceftriaxone and azithro going to cut it or not? Right? Can I use a narrow spectrum combination or do I need broader? And what we found out was we analyzed it by the operationally important question, which was it turned out for those patients in my hospital setting coming to my ICU, 20% of patients are going to get initially inappropriate therapy if they're getting ceftriaxone and azithro reflexively as the only things we're giving out in the ED. Now, does that tell me about who I should separate and how? No, it doesn't. But it tells me that probably, piperacillin, tazobactam, vancomycin's too broad for a lot, but it's the Goldilocks spot for a decent amount. And again, it gets back to knowing your pretest probability and looking at your own data. And again, working with your PharmD, they can segregate out for me as we talk. Well, which of these pneumonias that you're showing me these cultures from are from patients who developed it while they were in the ICU versus patients who presented to the ED? And it's amazing to see the discordance.
And I think with those HCAP patients as well, there's often previous micro, they're in the hospital system and have presented before. It's really important to look back at that as well.
We can make fun of our ED colleagues because none of them are here, right? But, it's amazing. The ED doesn't know how to look back more than a week in a chart, right? And, that's what all of us do is we're like, oh, let's go to the micro tab. And it's like, oh my God, look what they grew left.
This is a question Andy, I'll ask you. What is the role of aminoglycosides for empiric therapy if my common beta lactams are below 80% susceptibility, but amikacin and TOBA are 90% or higher? And this is common, right, where we'll see the aminoglycosides having by far the best susceptibility. I know you sort of addressed this in your talk, but I think it's worth just reiterating.
I don't think anybody would use monotherapy with an aminoglycoside for pneumonia because of lung penetration. That doesn't mean I don't rely on it to plug a hole when I'm using my backbone beta-lactam or carbapenem to do its work. And again, recall, we actually do have two recent well-done randomized controlled trials of inhaled amikacin with appropriate nebulizers, hooked up the ventilators, yep. timing with the respiratory therapy system so it actually doesn't deposit in the back of the endotracheal tube, no benefit of inhaled amikacin. And that's with special formulations, not the pull off the shelf in the basement, pour it in a nebulizer and pray. So, you know, the amikacin backbone has a value, but it's as an adjunct, not as a monotherapy or as a nebulized therapy.
And I think a lot of times, in the, you know, as Andy was saying, super sick patients, either patients who are acutely presenting and are septic and fulminant pneumonia or are decompensating and getting septic, like the case we presented, you know, that's the time, you know, initially where you can plug a hole. If you're not sure what you're dealing with, you absolutely can add an aminoglycoside. It doesn't have to be that you're committing for a week a full, but it certainly can acutely broaden your coverage so that you have something on board that that might be active.
Now, again, in the old days, did we use a quinolone? Sure. In my hospital, quinolones have less than 35% activity against Pseudomonas, so it adds nothing.
I think for us, we use them more frequently when we don't have these other agents. Sometimes we go to a continuous infusion carbapenem and then add on the aminoglycoside because there's lack of better options for us.
One of the issues that came up in the slides with the guidance from IDSA, which I think conflicts with the HAPVAP guidelines, is HAPVAP will, you know, I'm not saying, and I personally don't think this is based on good evidence, but they do recommend for, you know, septic patients who have a pseudomonal pneumonia and are septic, they have a weak recommendation for definitive combination therapy, particularly for difficult to treat pseudomonas. The guidance does not really say that, but what do you do? And there's not a, obviously, I don't think there's a right answer here, but what do you usually do, Andy?
If they're sick, it's not, they're getting combination therapy.
That's what I
just unless said. I know that they're colonized with a certain MDR pathogen and in consultation with my ID colleagues, we've decided to do something different.
Yeah. And I feel the same way. I think particularly in the, you know, in the super sick, as you're saying, sick is not. And also these high inoculum infections where, you know, initially when I feel like, you know, there might be inoculum effects or emergence of resistance, again, it's not based on any good clinical data, really. But, you know, those are the instances where I will at least initially like to use combination. Again, not committing them to 2 or 3 weeks of combination therapy, but at least trying to get that inoculum down and get them out of the woods.
And the absence of proof isn't proof of an absence, right? A kind of study in those people with that question would require 8,000 patients and be never executed. And so you weigh risks and the benefits and trade-offs of that individual patient.
So the question was about standardly, how long do you routinely treat VAP for? And I'll ask Marion and Andy.
So yeah, routinely we do 7 days. I think for Pseudomonas VAP, a little bit more controversial now, whether or not you need to go longer. But typically what we have done with that information is, again, look at our patient. How sick are they and how likely are they to survive a reoccurrence? Should that happen? But generally speaking, we cap therapy for most patients at 7 days.
Yeah, we do the same. We don't do a procalcitonin guided approach, which is an alternative way. And I would echo the point that the absolute right duration of therapy for a documented pseudomonal pneumonia is unknown. 14 days is probably too long. 7 for some subgroup of them is probably too short. And there are randomized controlled trials of shorter courses of therapy in Pseudomonas. And it's not only higher recurrences, but death rates. If you look at a doripenem versus imipenem study published a couple of years ago, when they stopped the dory at 7 days, the pseudomonal death rate went, whoosh. But, you know, what's the right range between 7 and 14? Yeah, it depends on the patient. And the point is, more than 14 days, 21 days, all these things that people were doing when I was in training.
Yeah, me too.
Absurd, right? More is not better. More is actually worse.
So, yeah, and I'll, you know, echo what these guys have said. Remember, it's effective therapy. And, in this, you know, it's not effective therapy on day 5 when they've been struggling along. These are, you know, usually pretty good care. You've got good treatment on early. And also, you got to look at the patient. I mean, if they're still struggling and not improving, you know, they're just starting to turn the corner at day 5 or 6. You know, those are patients you probably want to go a little bit longer. And if they're rock stars on day 2 or 3 and you're almost ready to come off the vent, I mean, those are might be your 7 or 8 dayers. So you know, when all else fails, look at the patient, see how they're responding. The question is about extended infusions in the ICU to Dr. Shore.
Oh, and again, I'd be curious for what you two say. So the extended, you know, I think we've all learned that optimizing pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics, and that's even now questions on the critical care certification examination, is important. And so with a lot of the novel agents, you see extended infusion times built into them, 2, 3, 4 hours. You know, when you're talking about what Marion illustrated, which is continuous infusion carbapenem, when's the right time to do that? And nobody knows the answer. We have a series of studies from the Australians called Bliss 1 and 2. And in those studies, they show that with continuous or extended infusion, carbapenem, cefepime, what have you, you are more likely to hit the pharmacokinetic target that's associated with good outcomes. And in one of the more recent trials, they showed a mortality advantage. What they didn't tell you was what the actual resistance patterns of those pathogens were. So if you live in an ICU where you've got some ugly pathogens, this might be the right thing to do. If you're in an ICU where you've got good agents and good susceptibility, I'm not sure what the benefit is, and you're going to piss off your nurses by tying up a line. The reason we have not moved to it more routinely is not that my nurses can't do it in the ICU, but when I whip out their central line to send them to the floor, and they've got one 22-gauge peripheral IV, I can't tie that up with an extended infusion anything. And so we're kind of frustrated, which, well, in 3 days we did extended infusion, and then on the floor, everything evaporated. But I don't know what you guys are doing.
Marion?
Like, I think extended infusions make a lot of sense. Like I said, we implement them in the setting of MDR resistance where we have, but not routine. I think we have to move that way. We're losing Piptazo as a drug for us, and we don't have a lot of other options. So I think actually on our list of our stewardship priorities is to get our ICU to do more extended infusion. So currently, no, they do not get a standard. They get a standard infusion, not an extended infusion.
So I'd say at Detroit Medical Center, when I was there, we implemented extended infusions for all anti-pseudomonal beta-lactams, and it went very smoothly. I hear what you're saying about going to the floor. I think, you know, in the ICU and the acute phase of illness are probably the most important. We're implementing for certain targeted anti-pseudomonals at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson and at Michigan. We did it when I was there too. I think important things to remember, your first dose should not be extended. If you want to get on board as quickly as possible, and I know some algorithms use extended infusion for initial dose, which makes zero sense to me. I think you want to get antibiotics on board quickly initially and then extend. And I think what Andy said is really important. You know, on the individual patient level, it's going to be those borderline MIC pathogens where you're going to make the difference. I wonder, and, you know, I think from a stewardship perspective, whether by optimizing PK and optimizing potency and, you know, time above MIC, et cetera, whether we might preserve these antibiotics longer and more of a global level or at a hospital level. I don't think there's evidence for that, but, you know, I wonder whether it might do good in the long run. But I think the individual patient levels where data has been most impressive, that it makes a difference for these borderline MICs. The question is, why don't you put rapid diagnostics in the ICU and get rid of empiric therapy? Yeah. And, you know, I think that's a really good point. I think Andy's point about differentiating colonization from not colonization is important. And it sounds like the newer generation is going to be effective. I think the ideal specimens to do these on are BALs. And there are many, you know, the guidelines for HAPVAP in the US, Andy shared the European guidelines, which are I think, very pro-BAL. The US guidelines don't really recommend them. They're very lukewarm on. So I think it's a hurdle where it's going to be a process change in a lot of places. I think people think BAL, they still think bronchoscopic, and you don't really need to do that as often anymore. You know, again, I think you need the infrastructure. What are you going to do with the results? Are you really going to follow the results? Are you not going to cover certain organisms if they're present? Are you going to believe everything that you grow? And I, you know, Andy, what are your thoughts? I mean, I know we talked a little bit about this, but
part of my concern is what we know about point of care testing in hospitals is the more point of care testing you have, the more testing you have. And more testing isn't always a good thing, right? Because it's easy to get, people get it because they're like, oh, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to order more tests. And so you don't have good diagnostic stewardship. The other point is I think that first dose is always going to be empiric. because someone's getting sick right in front of you. You don't
have to.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't even think you can know. I mean, that's always going to be empiric.
But I understand your point, though. Yeah. You're shortening the window hugely.
And in the U.S., the issue is every time we want to do point of care, my pathology lead has a seizure because of the CLIA implication.
Yeah.
Right. Even to get the medicine residents signed off to do occult hemocults, I mean, to do hemocult stools, was a monster project for the residency this year. So could you imagine what it would be for BAL rapid diagnostics? So I think we've kind of made ourselves our own worst enemy in some ways, but those are the realities.
Thank you very much to our expert faculty, and thank you to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full Anticipating Resistance in HAPVAP, Strategies to Improve Empiric Regimens in the ICU Program, on the Clinical Care Options website, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. And please be sure to check back for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you.